Good morning and good Chodesh. So we're starting off Rosh Chodesh Elul with a continuing our series. Today we're going to continue with the series of the six ubiquitous virtues. The idea of that there are six general categories of virtues, universal virtues, and we're examining each one through a Torah lens. I want to start off by thanking this morning Mr. Nissen Mail, who's sponsoring today. He said it's for his wife's anniversary. For Mazel Tov for 67 years.
Wow.
And Metz Hashem, many, many, many more. It's an aspiration and an inspiration for us all. I want to thank Jack and Barbara Siegel, who are also sponsoring Le'ilui Nishmas, Jack's mother, whose Yotzad is? This Wednesday. Le'ilui Nishmas, I'm sorry. Chana Rochel Bas Moshe, thank you very much for being part of the shir. So let's think about this together. What we're going to do is today we're going to focus on the virtue of justice. Okay, justice sounds like a very Jewish concept. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, following justice. But it's interesting that the way it's categorized in the world of psychology is it has three subcategories, which are not necessarily the ones you would have thought of. And they are teamwork, fairness, and leadership. So it's interesting how you just fit those all together. The general rubric is that justice describes strengths that make life fair. They are broadly interpersonal and describe the best interaction between individual and groups and a group or community. And I want to be honest, I think this is very much an anachronistic, a sort of a very much a modern, postmodern kind of way of looking at things. We'll see why in a second, meaning the language we're going to be hearing or seeing is very much something which is of today's era. Where we hear about the teamwork and the fairness, so to speak, in society. So let's look at each one individually. Teamwork. So if this is one of your signature strengths, this is something which relates to you. This is something which is citizenship, teamwork, and loyalty. You excel as a member of a group. You are a loyal and dedicated teammate. You always do your share, and you work hard for the success of your group. So just interesting, a little bit of research which was done. There's been a group of people who put together what's called the Marshmallow Challenge, not the Delayed Gratification Experiment. The Marshmallow Challenge is an experiment in which people have the opportunity, they're given a certain amount of spaghetti, dry spaghetti noodles, and a fixed amount of tape and string, and a marshmallow. And the restriction is that I believe it's in 18 minutes or 20 minutes they have to assemble the tallest self-standing structure with these, and it has to balance the marshmallow on top. And so they did this across hundreds, thousands of people across the country, different groups, different echelons of society, different age groups, different qualifications, and they found that they just did a lot of testing as to how this really works. How does the teamwork in fact work? Because it has to work with collaboration. They find that usually, there's a TED talk on this, which is very fascinating, that usually the first few minutes are spent, you know, planning or jockeying for power. The next one, sort of planning, and then most of the time is spent assembling. At the very end, there's usually a moment where time is crunching, and they'll say, it's the moment where somebody will say, okay, time is up in a minute, let's put the marshmallow on, and at that point in time, either the building collapses, or ta-da, it's a ta-da moment, and everything fits together. They found a very fascinating thing. The lowest group, the lowest performing group of all the teams, can you imagine what it is? Which group of which profession? Graduates of?
Harvard.
Business school. All business school are the lowest achievers in terms of teamwork, and the lowest achievers in terms of height of structure. Their average structure is 10 inches. As opposed to, guess the highest achieving group besides the architects, kindergarten graduates. That fascinating? That's unbelievable. That's unbelievable. What that means is, one of the reasons they attribute that is because in a business plan, usually what happens is they set up a specific plan, and they have one goal, they have one specific plan they want to reach, and they usually run out of time, and then they put it on mid-structure, and it falls down. Whereas in kindergarten, the kids are willing to try different things, so they keep trying the marshmallow every 2 minutes in a different place. And so they have numerous prototypes to be able to see if it's working or not, and also there's a lot less ego involved. So it's a very fascinating, meaning to say the average kindergarten graduate group has a structure of over 30 inches, and average business school is 10 inches. It stands. That's crazy. Okay, just there's another interesting statistic. They found that CEOs slightly outperform average people. Average people have a structure of 20 inches on average. And CEOs, when in a group, actually perform at about 22 inches average. You know, but they found that when they have an executive assistant with the CEOs, they get well into the 30s, which means to say that there's certain people who just know how to facilitate. It's not so much about the ideas, it's not so much about the engineering, it's about facilitating the group work, which is necessary. And that crucial person in the office, or that crucial person who knows how to work with people, is necessary for the teamwork. Very fascinating. It really helps us understand ourselves to a certain degree. And of course, the highest performing group is the engineers and architects, which is, of course, necessary. Because we depend on them for that. The next kind of category is fairness, equity, and justice, where if you're in part of this category, this is one of your signature strengths. You treat all people fairly, is one of your abiding principles. You do not let your personal feelings bias your decisions about other people. You give everyone a fair chance. And this is very much, I think, one of the flagships of today's society. Very, very much so today. It is interesting that actually research has been done to show that, in fact, this is actually something which is so ingrained in psyche that even on even animals actually respond to this. So, for example, there's been an experiment which is done where they have two monkeys in cages right next to each other. They can see through to each other, and they're given a task to perform. So these monkeys are monkeys that have known each other, and they've been put into a cage, and they're given a task. The task is they're given a stone. They have to take the stone and return it to the person. And when they do that, they get a gift, or they get their payment. The payment is, in this particular case, they get a cucumber. Right, so for them that's the payment, and they keep doing it every time they're given a stone. So what they did is they start doing this where in the one monkey would get a cucumber, and the one next door to it would get a grape. Right, it doesn't just cost more, it also tastes better. And so the first time, the first monkey gets a cucumber and starts eating it. The second monkey gets a grape. So the monkey turns to the side and starts looking and banging on the side wall. Okay, then he performs the task a second time. And gets a cucumber. So he takes the cucumber and throws it straight back at the person. Which means to say there's something ingrained. And the next time, the third time around, the monkey takes the rock and starts hitting against the side of the cage to make sure the stone's the same stone. Right, there's a certain sense of basic equity, basic fairness, which is ingrained in not just humans, but in the animal kingdom. And we have an opportunity many times of exercising or perhaps ignoring this strength during the course of our lives. Finally, the last one is, of course, this is a very, very broad topic, which is leadership. You excel at tasks of leadership, encouraging a group to get things done and preserving harmony within the group by making everyone feel included. You do a good job organizing activities and seeing that they happen. Now, this is a very, very, very broad topic. There are numerous books, numerous volumes written on this, and there's so many different models of leadership. So it's a very broad category, but fitting into the rubric of justice, it's in a certain sense the ability to be able to make it work for everybody, whether that mean top down or whether that mean delegation, whichever way we're looking at it. We'll come back to this in a moment. So these are the three general topics within where the three general strengths that express this notion of justice. We're going to explore them from a Torah perspective, and we'll see some of them are very much what the Torah has been talking about long before the leadership books were written. At the same time, some of them are going to be a little more nuanced than necessarily would have seen from that. So let's start at the very beginning. So when it comes to teamwork, okay, is teamwork a Jewish value? So the first thing you need to do is you need to do a translation test. Okay, so does the word teamwork actually translate? Creatively, right? You have to have a little bit of poetic license there. So it's not exactly a teamwork like sort of like, you know, everybody like working together with the same color t-shirts is not exactly a Jewish value, but we do have similar values. We'll call it, I would say, more cosmic Jewish values than teamwork. And like, so for one example, what words come to your mind when we think about this kind of general idea? Tzibur, what else?
Kahal.
Achdus. Chavrusa. So we have different models of
Yisrael, because no single person can really do all the mitzvahs.
I want to start with Moshe's idea. So on Matan Torah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, to B'nai Yisrael, this is that says Vayanu Kol Am Vayamru Kol Aser Kol Asher Divar Hashem Nasev Nishma. Everything that Hashem said, we will do. Everything, like everything, even the footnotes, even the endnotes. What about the epilogue? You're going to do that all? You really try to do that? Says the Mishnah Chochma. Vayinu kol ha'am in Parshas Yisro. Vayinu kol ha'am yachto. Vayamru kol asher deber Hashem na'aseh. Hinei, mitzvah satara, yesh asher l'kohanim, v'yesh asher l'levim, v'yesh l'kohen gadol, v'yesh l'melech, or the Sanhedrin. V'yesh l'misha shiyesh l'karka ubeis, ubeis, right? Meaning you say, the mitzvahs depend on your circumstance in life. Some of them are, we'll call it circumstantial moments in life. So if I own a house, I have certain mitzvahs. Some of them are if I'm in Israel. But some of them are integral. So if I'm not a kohen, if I'm not a woman, if I'm not a man, it depending on who I am, if I'm a king, I'm not a king, you don't get to do certain mitzvahs. So how can they possibly say, God, we're doing everything? What do you mean everything? Let's be honest. You're not doing everything. It says, Rak bechlal Yisrael tzricha ha-Torah liskayem. The only way for the Torah to actually exist is in Klal Yisrael. In Klal means to say the unity, the units. The Kol Yisrael Arevim Zemoze. That's one of the words we see that's flashed around with this. When it comes to all Yisrael are, what's the word Arev literally mean? The responsible, the word Arev literally means a guarantor, which means to say that when others are not able to pay up, we pay up for them. So if I am a Kohen, and, right, so Mark, if you're a Kohen, when Mark does certain mitzvahs, we are the beneficiaries, and vice versa, giving trumas the kohen can't do, right? And therefore, while every person is doing their little share, ultimately, collectively, we're able to achieve that. Now, you notice that's a little different to teamwork. Do you see that? That's a little more, I would say, cosmic than teamwork. Teamwork is, yeah, we're all given the same task. You know, we're assigned by the professor to have a certain, you know, semester project together, and we're going to hang out and, you know, create our cross-subject project, whichever it's going to be. It's a little different to this. This is not because, you know, we have chosen to do this, but rather because we were chosen to do this. We were all given this task. Shalom?
It's just, it's different than teamwork because every person has to do their thing, but their work is not necessarily collaborative.
Correct. So we're sitting down and even brainstorming, correct.
But there are other collaborative models within.
There are many other collaborative models.
Something like Binyan Beis HaMikdash is a collaborative model.
Correct. When it comes to, if you think about all the Nedivos Lev and so on. So there are many, many examples. I want to just start at the top. If you just to appreciate it. One or two other examples just to appreciate this. Here's an idea in Machshava. I think this is a very profound idea. And this opens up for many, many different avenues, more than just one specific one. So here's how it goes. Noach is in the Teva. It's been a long time. He hasn't seen dry land for a while. And off he goes, Vayashalach Esa Arev. So he sends off the raven, Vayatse Yotso Vashov Al Yavosh Samaimi Ela Oretz. And it comes backwards and forwards until it's dry, which means, translation, it didn't find anything, right? There was no land for it to find, so therefore it returns without any olive branch, right? That's why I did not get the picture. It was the dove, right? It's interesting that the Medrash adds to us a subtext. There's a conversation which is being had between the Arev and Noach. Here's how the conversation goes. Amar Loi. So Noach says to this raven, which is obviously unsuccessful at its journey, Ma tzorech lo elam bach. What do we need you? Why does the world need ravens? Lo elachila v'lo lekarban. We can't eat you. You're a non-kosher bird, and you're not effective on the Mizbeach. So basically, you are not the vehicle towards anything. You don't have any purpose. So why do you exist? Obviously, Noach is frustrated with its mission not being fulfilled for whatever reason. Rabbi Berechia, b'shem Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana Omar. So Rabbi Berechia says, Amalai Kodesh Baruch Hu Kabloi. So Hashem says, take it easy. Accept this raven. Understand that the raven has a form and function. The world will need him. Now, obviously, the world has not been waiting for this one moment. Obviously, this is an example of a moment. So the world needs him. Why? When is that going to be? When the water will dry up from the earth. Because obviously now, the entire world is covered. There's going to be a tzaddik who's going to dry up the entire world. And I'm going to need the raven for him. That's why it says the ravens would bring him bread in the morning, bread and meat in the morning and the evening. Moshe, hold on for a second. Who is that?
Eliyahu.
Okay. There we go. So this is Eliyahu. So
I wanted
to give everybody so let's think about this for a second. This is Eliyahu Anavi. So the ravens are the intermediary between him and the food. Now let's think about this for just a brief moment. It happens to be, yes, the raven is mentioned twice in Tanakh. But the Midrash isn't just sort of like, you know, control F, you know, arave, right? Oh, happens to be. There happens to be that there's two araves. By the way, of course, the word arave sounds similar to...
Aravus,
right? It sounds like similar to the word guarantor, right? So it should make us think about these things. So what is the Midrash really saying over here? What's the Midrash saying? That there's something Noach is missing is to be found later on at the times of Eliyahu. So let's just recap what is going on with Eliyahu at this point in time. Why is it that the ravens are bringing him bread and meat in the morning and the evening? Where is he right now?
He's running away from Yezebel.
So he is actually not. This is not the Yezebel pursuit. This is the earlier one where he's running away. Because what happens is the following: he's in a place called Nachal Chris in the Valley of Chris, and it's because Eliyahu enters the stage. We don't have much background to Eliyahu. Enters Eliyahu into the stage. This is in Melachim Perek Yud Zayin. This is actually the Melachim Aleph Perek Yud Zayin. He walks in and he says, "When you carry on behaving like you do, Achav, who's the king at the time, there's going to be a drought. There's not going to be any rain." And he runs into hiding because he is the one facilitating this drought. He hides in Nachal Chris. There is no food to be had. And the ravens come and provide him with food. Now, there's a lot of symbolism in this whole episode. Let's think about this for a brief moment. This is the way that the Midrash describes it in Devarim. The Midrash says, "Amar Rabbi Yehuda b'Rabbi Eli, al shloisha dvarim tzavu Yisrael b'chnisa sam la'aretz." There are three things the nation of Israel were responsible for entering into the land of Israel when they entered. Ve'eluhen limchois zaroi zikro shalamayil, to raise the remembrance of Amalek, lemanos lohem melech, to establish a king, v'livnos lohem beis anochi mikdash, to build a beis anochi. U'mini lohem melech, they did have a king. U'machu zikro shalamalek, they almost completely wiped out the memory of Amalek. V'lama lo bonu lohem beis mikdash. Why in the time of David HaMelech did they not build a Beis HaMikdash? Now Tanakh in Devar HaYomim gives us a reason, but the Midrash is giving us an additional reason because it's ambiguous in Sefer Melachim. Shayu b'neihem delo torin, because they couldn't get along with each other. Because the Jews had arguments. Teida, how do you know? To Amar Rabbi Yishmur, Shmur bar Nachman, Doro shel Achav, Ovdei Avodas Kochavim hayu. The generation of Achav, that's the generation Eliyahu was confronting, were serving Avodah Zarah. They were pretty bad people. They would go out to battle and they would win battles. Okay, why so? They did not have any conflict between them. That's why they went out to war and won. When he went out to war, there were casualties. When Achav went out to war, there were no casualties. Why? Because it's interesting. What did David HaMelech lack that Achav had? They had a sense of unity, that a sense of camaraderie, that were able to work together. So let's go back to the symbolism for a brief moment. Let's think about this. Noach, that one missing piece of the puzzle. The Talmud Yerushalmi tells us in Peah, in the first parak, that the raven has a unique characteristic, and that is that they care for one another. It's actually it seems to be a dispute in the Gemara and Ksumas on Daf Nun, but the Midrash says that the ravens are a caring breed, that they care for one another, they take care of one another, in a certain sense of arvos, in a certain sense of communal responsibility. So Noach looks at the raven and he says, "I don't get it. Why are you so? What a useless creature!" What was he missing? He was missing the fact that the raven does have something. It does have a sense of responsibility. When is that sense of responsibility going to be expressed? Later on, to Eliyahu looks at his generation and says, "You empty, worthless generation. You deserve a drought." What does Hashem say? Hashem sends back the raven to him to say, "Well, you may not appreciate the fact that we'll call it their theological standing, but appreciate their communal standing. Look what they're able to achieve because they love each other." Eliyahu, give them a break. So Hashem is sending him food via the creature, which is representing what he's missing in the generation, the Arev itself, the raven itself. What a brilliant idea, but it also underlines a certain point, and that is that ultimately, David HaMelech's generation didn't have us. They were great tzaddikim. They did a lot of wonderful things, but they were still missing this. That means to say that if you're thinking about sort of translating that idea of Arevus, not just in terms of we'll call it a professional development portfolio of mitzvahs and we're all achieving together, basic survival is dependent on this. That's what seems to be is mentioned in this Midrash. And moreover, it seems to be that if we go one step further, that means to say that ultimately that seems to be even the prerequisite for the Kiyum HaMitzvahs. Meaning, the basic foundation is being able to get along with one another. A bigger team, okay, Elias?
Yeah, I would point to a theological paradigm on collaboration in Na'aseh Adam.
Very interesting. Very beautiful idea. That actually requires a lot of thought, because the seminal moment of creation requires consultation, right? So if you think about that, the seminal moment of creation of the human requires consultation and collaboration. For whatever reason, Hashem chose to want to have collaboration. If you think about that on a human level as well, there's also the most intimate moment of creation is a collaboration. If you think about that, that's represented again in the same fashion. There's a lot of very, very powerful ideas about how God decided that creation should work. It's not a singular episode. Very, very powerful idea, and you're right. That's another example that I didn't even get there. One other idea I wanted to just think about over here is that again, it seems to be something which is working within the rubric of Judaism. Meaning to say, it isn't just like whoever we find a project to, there's a value of teamwork. It doesn't seem like the Torah spends so much time emphasizing that. It seems to be that it's within the context of Torah. So an example is the Dagalim, the flags. When were the flags given to all the tribes? Which point in history? In the Middle East. But the problem is like this. Look, if you want to be very specific about it, we know exactly when they were invested. Because it tells us, this is the first pasuk again, Bamidbar, which is why it's called Bamidbar. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe, Bamidbar Sinai v'Oel Moed, Be'echad l'chodesh ha'sheni, b'shana ha'shenis. When was this whole census, and therefore flag institution, brought about? It was in the second year, in the second month. Now, folks, they had been moving up till then. They'd been doing a lot of moving, in fact, if you look at Parshas Maaseh. They'd been doing a lot of moving, which means to say that they're only getting this whole, you know, formation and flags and identity business only after they actually get together in the second year and the second month. So what were they doing up till now? They're probably like more like regular Jewish travel, right? So, you know, everybody all at once. So how does this work? So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky has a brilliant insight. Their first MS Liakov on Parshas Bamidbar says, you know what? Creating teams is a dangerous thing. You know, when you start divvying out different identities, different colors for color war, there's a certain amount of competition which is to be had, and that could actually be self-destructive. So therefore, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm going to give this to you in the second year and the second month. After what? After there's been
a
Matan Torah and a Mishkan. Once there's a Mishkan in the center, now I have the common mission statement. Now that I have the common mission statement, I can say, okay, so I'm going to create the teams around that mission statement who are going to encamp, centered around that, and now we can work because we all know what we're aiming for. Before that, it's too dangerous. After that, it's necessary because we're different. That's a very powerful, powerful model. It reminds me of my favorite joke. I have to apologize, but it just makes me feel so warm inside that I have to that I have to take the opportunity. So the Jewish university has a crew team. I'm sorry if anybody remembers this. So the Jewish university has a crew team, and they're not very good. It's more like the Jewish football team. You know, it doesn't make it to the C League even. You know, so they're not really good. But it's not really so much of an issue of strength. So they can't work out what's the problem. So they send off Yankel, who's going to be a spy. So it's for the Harvard team. Harvard does usually very well in crew. And so off he goes. He's sitting there in the bulrushes of the Charles River on the riverbank, spying the training early in the morning as the crew team works. You know, they have to start at 4 a.m. It's a very arduous sport to be involved in. So there they are standing. He's standing on the riverbank. He watches for 3 days consistently in the mornings and in the late evenings. Comes back and they say, Nyanko, what's the secret? So he says, it's amazing. They've got a phenomenal strategy. That what they do is that they only have one person screaming and seven people rowing. My favorite joke. Anyways, it says a lot. We're wonderful people, but we have a lot of people screaming a lot of the time. And so what the Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky is saying is that in order for it to work, in order for the teamwork to work, we need to have the common mission statement set out. We need to have the Torah there at the center. Then we can all start differentiating. And even when we differentiate, as soon as we start losing that Torah as the center, then things start splitting. So when you start seeing, you know, the exile of the Ten Shvatim didn't happen in one shot. If you look through Tanakh, in Malachim Beis, you see that the first of all happened to the East Bank tribes, who were more distant, and there was a vying for power in the north between the East and the West Bank of Israel. As they sort of differentiate themselves from Torah, as they're separating themselves from the Torah kingdom of the south, that's slowly what happens. Then the cracks turn into valleys. And the way we see it. Again, these are very big models. I think actually Eliot's model is a better example of what we'll call a more specific collaboration and more humanistic or universal collaboration, which is a great example. But nonetheless, this is where it comes into. And I just want to emphasize the fact that this is all in the context of Torah thought, in the context of the mission statement not being a, you know, a... circumstantial mission statement, but rather an intrinsic and value-based mission statement. Let's move on to the next level, which is fairness. I think this is fascinating. What does the Torah have to say about fairness? Does the Torah value fairness? Let's do the translation test over here. Is there a translation for the word fair? Yes, in Israel you say, if something's not fair, you say zeloh.
Fair.
Right, exactly. So it's 100% a Jewish concept. Right, so, but nonetheless, the reason we struggle for a lack of terminology is because the words we use, let's try to think about the words that we would use instead.
Yashar.
So yashar is one of the words, like straight, what else?
Shaveh.
Shaveh, interesting. Yeah. And that's more in a common usage today, less than the way Tanakh uses it.
Tzedek.
Tzedek is righteousness, but you see that justice, it's sort of righteousness, justice. That seems to be more than a fairness. That's what's interesting. If we were to... And that's what's fascinating to me is tzedek tiridof, the fairness seems to be more about justice than it does about everybody coming home with the same flavor ice cream, right? So it's we have to appreciate the difference between equality and equitability as well within Judaism. Let's take a look at some models. So here's an example. Let's see over here. So the Torah tells us when Yisra comes in, good father-in-laws have good advice some of the time. Yisro comes in and he says to Moshe Rabbeinu, look, Moshe, you're not going to survive this by yourselves. Let me make a suggestion. You should, and you should appoint them as your leaders. And they should be your co-judges who are going to help you along the way. Fantastic. What is it, all these descriptions about? Why do we need to have all these different levels of leaders? So, Anshei Chayil, what does that mean, literally? Are you familiar? Rashi tells us, what does Anshei Chayil mean?
Wealthy.
They need to be wealthy. For it to be a judge, you need to be wealthy. Now, that's not just because it's a lack of meritocracy. Why does Rashi say that? When you're somebody who's independently wealthy...
Maintain their objectivity.
It maintains their objectivity. Meaning, when to say somebody comes in front of them, they're not going to be swayed by either the pity of the individual or perhaps the power of the individual. Those are both different directions of being swayed. Right? So that means to say, in order to maintain objectivity, they need to be independently wealthy, not getting their paycheck from this institution. Similarly, Sone Botza, Rashi says, Shesone is Mamona Badin. They're not interested in money. They're not interested in what's being slipped to them when. Rashi says, the previous idea, Anshei MS, he says, Eli Bala Havtocha Shehem Kadal Yismoich Al Divrehem, Shal Yedeikain Yehu Divrehem Nishmaim. There are people whose word is their word. You know, so when they say something, they say something. They don't backpedal it and they don't change it depending on public opinion. They mean what they say. And they say what they mean, Horton. Right? So this is what Rashi says over here. So this is the model of what leadership is meant to be. So who is... How far does this go? So just some examples the Gemara talks about this. In Ksuba stuff, Kufay or Beis. Some examples of this. This is such a shocking statement. It is so terrifying. The Gemara says the following. Ki Asar Adimi... When Rav Dimi came, by the way, whenever you see Rav Dimi coming, he's coming from
Eretz Yisrael,
right? He took a trip there, he came back, and he's reporting a lot of the things that he heard there. So Rav Dimi comes back, and he says, Omar, Dorosh Rav Nachman Bar Kohen, Maidich Sivor, to say, Mishle Melech B'Mishpat Yamid Eretz, V'ish Terumois Yehar Sena. The king will establish the world, and the person who is a person of donations will destroy the world. What is he referring to? The Gemara says something really shocking. The Gemara says, Im Dome Dayan LeMelech, She'enot Tzorich L'Klum, Yamid Eretz. If the person yielding judgment is like a king who does not need anybody, it's not a voting, it's not a democracy, then their judgments are based on truth. If they're like that in terms of their judgment capability. If a person's judgment is yielded like a kohen, whose sustenance is based on going from granary to granary, why? Because they need trumos, then they're going to destroy the world. Why? Because of bias. Can you imagine that? That's unbelievable. That means to say, that's why the Kohanim are not necessarily given a seat. Because their payroll is coming from the source of the people who they're dealing with. That's a shocking statement. That's how far bias goes. I remember I was once at a jury selection, and you know, and they're going through the whole room, and it was about a medical malpractice, and so they said, anyone in your family is the person down the road. Anybody in your family, you know, have anything to do with? Oh yes, yes, my uncle. But I believe that I'm objective to this. What are you talking about? if you have any exposure to anything of the same subject, you are not an objective bystander. Don't pretend to yourself as if you have some sort of magical way of escaping this. This is what the Gemara seems to be saying over here. When you're somewhat connected, how far? Examples. The Gemara goes on to give examples. He has an example. Kiara Shmuel. Shmuel was one of the earliest Amoraim, one of the earliest generations of the Amoraim. He says the following. Have Ovid b'Mavra. He was crossing a bridge. Asahu Gavra Yoiv LeYode. Somebody gave him a hand. Bridges weren't exactly the GW in those days. You know what I'm saying? So you know, if the wind blew, so did you. So a fellow offers him a hand to go across the bridge, and he says, "Ah, Amalei Ma'avid Etcha." He says, "So what do you do? What are you here for?" He says, "Amalei Dina Isli." He says, "Oh, I'm on the way to a court case." So what does he say? "Amalei Pasil Lochal Dina." I'm invalidated. I'm recusing myself from this case because you offered me a hand. Shmuel was able to understand in his own bias that he would not be able to be a fair judge. Another example. This example is even more shocking. Rabbi Shmuel Brady Rabbi Yossi have a regular risay to have a maisile called Mali Shabsa Kintod Piri. So he had a field. He was not exactly a farmer, so he hired somebody who would be a sharecropper. That fellow would take care of the fields. Every Erev Shabbos, he'd bring in the fruits of the yield, and that guy would keep some of it. That was the deal. So the guy comes in, and that was Erev Shabbos that he'd get. Chad, Yumachad, one day, Isile. He came in on Thursday, not Friday. Amalei, Maishna Ha'idna. What's different today? Amalei Dino Isliva Amira Agav Urchi Isilei Lamar. So he says, look, Judgment Day in town is Monday and Thursday. That's the market day. So if I'm coming in for judgment, then why don't I bring you your goods today so I don't have to make two trips? Nothing nefarious, right? Just pretty regular, straight down the road. Amalei Loi Kabil Mine. He didn't receive it from him, so he refused to take the fruit, and still, Amalei Pasil Loch Aladina. He still said, even though I'm not taking the fruit, I still feel especially indebted to you because you brought my food early. He says, I'm Oisiv Zuzad Rabbon of Kaidinan Le. So he gave it to the other judges, and they were listening, they were judging him. Bahadi de Ka'azil of Asi, but Amalei, boy toin hachi, boy toin hachi. So he stood there outside listening to the court case and he says, oh, he should have just said that. Oh, the defense, I can't believe he missed out that integral proof. He says, Omar, Tipach Nashon Shomakable Shoichad. He says, well, and he called himself and he said, woe to those people who take bribes. He says, Umar Ani Shalani Talti, I didn't even take it, I refused the fruit. Vim Natalti Shalina Talti. It was my own fruit. It was my own fruit, it was my field. If you're getting from somebody else something which you're not owed, which is not yours, and is not indebted to you, then how much more so? Rabbi Shmuel says is the human condition is such that we are biased. So if we're biased, we recognize that, and this is how far it goes. But if you notice that all these cases are cases about judges, about leaders. So what does that have to do with us? Meaning on a regular basis, I don't know about you, but we're not adjudicating or arbitrating, right? I mean, things get tough at home sometimes, but not like, you know, we're not making major colossal decisions in people's lives. How far does this go? So the Gemara gives other examples. There's numerous examples, just one example, which is a very beautiful example. The Gemara in Shabbos Daf Kufroch Zayin Mabez says the following. Now, imagine for a moment you were in the circumstance. Because imagine you are this worker, and try to sort of imagine what the thoughts that would be going through your mind. The Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, Adon Chaveru Lekav Schus, Danin Noiso Lekav Schus. If you judge your friend favorably, you're going to get the same treatment from God. How does this work? So you have a fellow who lives in the Upper Galilee, goes down south because that's where work is to be found at the time, and he rents himself out, shalosh shanim, for 3 years. That's quite a contract, right? So he's working for 3 years. He hasn't been home. Erev Yom Kippurim, Omer Loi, he says, one Erev Yom Kippur, ten nischari ve'elech, ve'ezon es ishti, v'anai. I mean, it's such a different world. I'm going home now after 3 years. You wouldn't mind just giving me a little bit of food so I can now sustain my family, because that's what I've been doing all this for, right? Pretty reasonable request, right? Says, I'm so sorry. I forgot to mention to you, I don't have any cash. So the man says, Amaloi, tiny payros? Okay. You know, I've been tending your fields. At least give me some fruit. Says, Amaloi, Ainli. I'm sorry, no fruit. So tiny karaka, okay, so in real estate maybe. Amy says, I don't have Telly Behema, okay. Give me liquid assets. Give me some movable animals. Amy, Telly Karuk Sosos, give me at least, like, you know, bedding so my family can sleep on something. Amy. Now imagine what you would do at this point in time. This guy is going straight to court. I mean, this is unbelievable. What does he do? What is his reaction? Hifshil He went very despondent. He went home. Wow. It sounds like that was the end of the conversation. He, you know, it doesn't sound like the employees are getting the right end of the stick over here. But nonetheless, he doesn't make a big deal about it. La'achar ha-regel, after regel, that means to say after sukkos. There's been like probably about a 2-3 week break. Nato balabayis schara biyada ve'imoy. So he said he went with three donkey fools and went up to the north and gave him his wages. At this point in time, he says, when I said I didn't have money, what do you think? So he says, So maybe you had a business investment that you had to spend your money on. There was a good opportunity, and you probably spent all your money. He says, "Oh wow, okay." So when I said I know animals, what did you think? So I thought that it must have been that you rented out your animals. Okay. When you asked for ground, I mean, you're working on my ground. What did you think? Maybe it was rented out to other people, so it really wasn't yours to give. When you said I didn't have fruit, maybe they weren't given. The master wasn't given, so I couldn't give it to you. I didn't even have pillars or beddings. Maybe you maktish everything, so you really had it, but it really wasn't yours. So the man says, "You're right, Amalei." He says, "Ha'uvda kachai hava haya." That's exactly what happened. I had a trouble with my son. I didn't want him to get the inheritance. I dedicated everything to Shemayim so it shouldn't be so it shouldn't be in his axis. But that's exactly what happened. And he blesses him and he says, and he went and he was matir his neder. And now that's why he could give him the food. Hashem should give you that discuss of fair judgment. That's unbelievable that how far that goes. I don't know if we ask to put ourselves in situations like that, but when we are in situations which are mayain that, that's how far the Gemara is saying. And this is not a judge, this is a regular fellow, this is an employee. We obviously have to stand up for ourselves, naturally. But there's a certain element of Dan Lekavskos, so I should think this society and as a whole is lacking. Now notice that the Gemara isn't talking about over here about being racially accepting or different to, rather this is not so much the tone of what you see in the Gemara, which seems to be more the tone of the fairness description that we've been talking about, but I think that it all starts at home. I remember somebody once said asked the following question. They said, in the end of the Shemoneh Esrei, we say, Sim Shalom Tov Avracha, place peace and goodness and bracha and all these kind of things. On the end of our call, Yisrael, on all of Israel. Baruch Atah Hashem V'Vorecha Samo Yisrael B'Shalom. What about world peace? Right? Meaning like, don't know about world peace in the end of the day? So I asked a Rav Shulman, actually, who was a Rebbe of mine at the time in YU. And I said, like, why are we so particularistic when it comes to the blessing of peace? So he said, and here's a Rav of Shul, he says, believe me, he says, there's enough pain and discord in one small corner of Judaism to require that we bless every day, that we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu for peace and bracha and tova in our little corner. That's where it starts. Not that it ends there, but that's where we need. If we can work that out, if we can overcome that, that's the starting point for going further. So in a certain sense, again, it's fairness as a whole, but it's fairness which expresses itself within the context of Judaism and outside. And just again, I want to mention the story because it's such a powerful story, and I've mentioned it many times before because it had a profound effect on me. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was once a dayan on a particular case. He was a judge, and it was late at night, and he had two litigants in front of him. One was an employer who was Jewish, one was an employee who was non-Jewish. It was a dispute about wages, who paid when, what, where, and who didn't. And in the middle of the court of the case, the fellow who's the Jew, who's the employer, says to him in Yiddish, he says, you know, cut me a good deal. Now, whenever a litigant says to you, cut me a good deal, that's a good indication that they are
guilty.
So, and the fact that he's saying in Yiddish also indicates that this is clearly an admission of guilt. So he stood up, he thumped the table, and he said, you pay him every cent right now. He forced the employer to pay the employee, and that was it. A few years later, he gets a knock on the door at 10:30 at night. There's a knock on the door, and it's that fellow, that employee, that non-Jewish fellow, he says, they're coming for you tomorrow morning, get out. He came to America because, the reason why he had the schus to come to America was because of the fact that his fairness transcended the lines of the tribe, transcended the experience. The reason why Rav Soloveitchik came to America was because Rav Moshe Soloveitchik brought him to America, just to appreciate that. Okay? I mean, the American Jewry was shaped because of this trade of fairness, which went well beyond. Last idea, just for the interest of time, don't want to stop too much, but the notion of leadership. So there's, if you go to any bookstore today, there's a whole section on leadership, and everybody who thinks they're a leader is writing about leadership, right? I read so many books about leadership that the person isn't really a particular leader, but they're about all the people they know who are leaders, and all the research they've done about leaders. I'm like, I prefer to hear from people who actually do the leadership to talk about how they did it, rather than the people who think that they are leaders telling us about how they other people are leaders. There's so much written on this. But does the Torah have anything to say on it? And the answer is, well, the Torah had a lot to say on it before the books were written, because the Bible still is the bestseller, and it still was talking about these things long before it all started. Four examples. First one that comes to Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, what was the first thing that Moshe Rabbeinu, what was the first words the Torah records that Moshe Rabbeinu ever says in his life?
Rosh Hashanah.
Oh, that's actually interesting. That is the first conversation. The first conversation he has with God is... When Hashem says this whole presentation, he says, "Who am I?
Humility.
Who am I? God, you think I'm worthy of leading the Jewish people? Not me. No. So what was the first action that Moshe Rabbeinu said? The first action that Moshe Rabbeinu does? He says, the case you're talking about. And he sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. He turns around, he looks this way, he looks that way, he sees there's no one. And he kills the Egyptian. Think about this for a second. The first real conversation he has with God is, who am I? But the first action he takes is, not like Rashi says, he goes to the future, he turns to the past. Look at Rabbi Jonathan Sacks says, look at the comment where he is right now. Right now, he looks around, he says, is there anybody who's standing up to this injustice in society? Is there anybody who's defending this poor slave over here? No one. So he goes and he kills him. The kind of leader that the Torah talks about is the person who, when called upon, says, "Mi anochi," but when situation arises, does what's necessary. That's the type of leader the Torah says. What a powerful example. There's so many people who are the opposite. There's so many people who are like, who are said, "Anochi," vote for me, right? And then when it comes to action, when it comes to, you know, drawing lines with international relations, then we'll delegate and we'll explain and we'll, you know, we have other ways of doing things. This is the model of a leader, the way the Torah
describes. That's why Vayigdal, he became great. Exactly,
this is his moment of Vayigdal. Moreover, an example, Moshe Rabbeinu, this is examples. Moshe Rabbeinu is looking for another leader. So this is in Parshas Pinchas, what does he do? He says, Yifkor Hashem lekei aruchos lekol basar, ish alayda, Hashem, please, ensure continuity, ensure that there's going to be a person who continues after me. Look at the way he describes Hashem. A way that Hashem has never been described in all of Jewish history. He says, Hashem, who is Elokei Haruchos V'Kol Basoi, the God of all the spirits of all the flesh. Why does he use that terminology? Why here does Moshe Rabbeinu pick this way of describing Hashem?
Because that's what Yeshua is going to have. So,
okay, so wait one second. So the reason is, Rashi says, it's very basic. It's like, Hashem Baruch Hu, look, there are a lot of people. There are a lot of people in the Jewish nation, and they have lots of different interests. Kashem Shepaneim and Domas Zulazul, just as their faces are dissimilar, so do their emotional makeups are dissimilar to one another. So it says, Akash Baruch, you understand all of them. Find somebody who can understand them. Right? Find somebody who can understand all the Ruchos, the Kol Basar, all those different folks who have different interests, who have different requirements and air conditioning temperatures, whatever it else it is. Find somebody who can appreciate all those differences. What does Hashem do? So two psukim later, Akash Baruch responds. He says, Vayemar Hashem El Moshe, Kach Lachos Yoshua Ben Nun. Take your Yoshua ben Nun, Ish Asher Ruach, by a man who's got the spirit in him, Vesomatos Yadacho Alav. Notice, what is Hashem doing? What is the message Hashem saying to Moshe Rabbeinu? You requested somebody who understands Kol Aruchos L'Kol Basar, who understands everybody. What does Hashem say? I want a leader who?
Understands
in the end
the
of the day,
understands the people.
In the end of the day, you've got to understand the people, but you have to have one policy. You can't have policy based on public opinion. A policy has to be dictated by Ruach Boy. One Ruach, and that's my Ruach. Meaning, the balance of a leader, a Torah leader, is supposed to be a person who has the empathy and understands everybody, but at the end of the day, all the decisions necessary to be made are made because of Ruach Boy, because there's one spirit on him, and that's God's spirit. That's a brilliant observation. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in a certain sense, is bringing Moshe back. He's pulling Moshe Rabbeinu in. You wanted somebody with empathy. Empathy is fine, but empathy doesn't make good leaders. You need empathy and direction in order to be able to create leadership. In terms of Moshe Rabbeinu's model of leadership, very powerful. A separate idea. Other example. Two more examples in the leadership realm. So here we go. When it comes to Moshe and Yoshua. So Moshe says the following. He's about to go into the land of Israel. We're about to get to these parashiyos right now. Vaymer lov, the ene kol Yisrael in front of everybody. Chazak ve'emotz ki ato tovoyes la'am hazeh. You are going to come with this nation. Okay, let's take note of the verb here. Ato tovoy. Now notice, where is this? Perek lamed out of pasuk Zion. Let's fast forward the same perek. Right, perek lamed out of pasuk chav gimel. That's in the same breath, same speech. Vayetzavis Yosha ben-Nun vayomer chazak ve'emotz. You should be strong. Ki ato tovoyes b'nei Yisrael. Because you're going to bring the nation of Israel. Notice it's not exactly the same verb. Before it was tavoy, now it's tavi. Tomato, tomato? No, they actually mean different things. What is it? What are the differences between them? The Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us. Ksiv ki ato tavoy, ksiv ki ato tavi. Tavoy means to go with, tavi means to bring. So it says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Omer Rabbi Yochanan, explaining this. Omer lo Moshe el Yoshua, atov azkenim shevadori mohem. At the beginning, it needs to be all of you together. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, tul makel v'hach al kod kodon. So it means to say that there's sometimes it needs to be collaborative and sometimes it needs to be actually directed. Meaning to say, sometimes it needs to be everyone together. Okay, folks, I'm running with you. I'm the CEO. We're all going together. I'm loading the copy machine with you. Right? And then sometimes it's like, no, sorry. Your job is to make sure you're on time. You need to be here when the people are arriving. Even though I'm in the office and doing other things, you need to be there. That's your job. Sorry. If you're not here, it's gonna be docked in your paycheck. That means to say that there's certain times where a leader needs to be tough voice with everybody. Sometimes the leader, she needs to be leading them and making sure. There's different models of leadership. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu is saying to Yeshua in the same breath, in the same speech. Because Moshe Rabbeinu recognizes this. Just again, the Torah itself, just by the way it describes leadership, is giving us the tools. Another and last example. Where that comes to Moshe Rabbeinu, and this I think is the most powerful of all the descriptions. There are two times in the Torah that we sing songs, and they both start with the words Az Yashir. The most famous one, of course, is Az Yashir Moshe v'nei Yisrael es Hashir Azaz. So we say that every day Az Yashir, the song of the sea. Fantastic. Happens to be there's another lesser known one which is in Parshas Chukas, and it is over here. Here is how it goes: Az Yashir Yisrael es Hashir Azaz Ali Be'er Anulah. It's also about water. It's about the well at this point in time, not the sea. Now, in the actual, we'll call it koteret, the introduction to the songs, there is a difference. What was the difference? Let's take a look back again. So when it comes to Az Yashir, as Az Yashir Moshe v'nei Yisrael as Hashir Azos, over here it is, Az Yashir Yisrael as Hashir Azos. What's missing? Moses, right? So it's interesting that, and now let's just appreciate the time differential. The first song was when they are entering into the desert. Moshe Rabbeinu is walking with the nation of Israel as they're walking in. Here he is, 40 years later, as Moshe Rabbeinu is, helping them exit the desert, says the Maharal of Prague on the Torah. Well, you know what the difference is over here? The greatest sign of a leader is that at the end of their journey, they no longer need to be the one conducting the choir. Yeah. They're still doing it. They're there. They're doing it. They're re-singing. That's the success. The greatest leader is the leader who's able to not be there watching and taking and docking and watching the time clock because they're doing it. That's the model of leadership. Again, this is such a vast topic that these are just vignettes of the bigger picture. But to appreciate that this is something which the Torah talks about descriptively, if not prescriptively, in so many episodes. And just to close, does the Torah talk about the virtue of justice? Absolutely and positively. It talks about both teamwork, fairness, and leadership, but perhaps in a different milieu. And a little more specific of an identity than it would be in the world of positive psychology. Thank you very much and have a wonderful week.